After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu and I'm back with Mind Rolling, and I'm with somebody new. We just met this second, and it's Oren J. Sofer. And Oren, welcome to Mind Rolling.
Thanks so much, Raghu. It's good to meet you, and I'm happy to be here.
And I have met Oren through a mutual friend and colleague, Sharon Salzberg, who you all know, who's on this Be Here Now network as well, and is a long, we were just reaching back to remember just how long ago it's been that Sharon and I met, and Ram Dass and Krishnas and all of us in India back in the day. So Oren has a wonderful new book, Your Heart Was Made for This, and as I look out, as we all look out into the extraordinary events that are going on in our world, we kind of look and go, "Our boy, we're going to have to enlarge in that heart, aren't we?"
Yeah.
Excuse me. And but who are you and where do you come from? Let's start there. I usually ask people, Oren, about how they realize that there was a path, basically, out of the kind of polarity that we grow into in our earliest childhood days and have a difficult time with, depending on the kind of atmosphere that we grew up in with our family. And I know you had some difficult times with your family, but just started, in those days and how those difficult times actually eventually were a blessing.
Yeah, thanks. So I grew up in Jersey, in North Jersey, middle-class family. Both my parents were Jewish. We had a dog and two cats, and I've got an older brother, and for many years had a very, really beautiful, blessed childhood. And as you kind of alluded to there, at a certain point when I was around 10, one of my family members started suffering from mental illness, actually had quite a dramatic psychotic break, and things turned upside down very quickly, and I was still quite young and small and found it all very frightening and just kind of went into what was my personality conditioning to be okay and to please others around me and to stay busy. And I got really good at staying busy. I was kind of classic overachiever, straight A student. We lived near New York City. I got involved with acting and theater, and I was a childhood actor and was running all over the city, going to auditions and actually acting some in different productions. And things didn't really catch up to me until I was an undergraduate at Columbia in New York. And a whole bunch of events kind of came together. My parents were getting divorced. I had this big falling out with my friends, broken up with my girlfriend, and I was doing a lot of drugs. And something shifted inside. I remember the moment I actually felt my belly and something very deep in my core kind of tremble. And it was like the tremor before an earthquake. Mm-hmm. I had this very clear, palpable sense of this immense energy of emotions that I had been suppressing and avoiding for so many years. And I felt like I want to stop running and I want to know who I am. A good friend of mine at the time, you know, said, you've learned to be whoever anyone else wants you to be as an actor and, you know, as in your family, but you don't know who you are. And so
you don't have to be an actor to go through that one.
No, not at all. It's,
we've all been there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just got really good at it through the acting.
Yeah. Yes.
And so I was very fortunate to have been taking some classes in Asian religion, and I had the opportunity to go to India and to study abroad in Bodh Gaya at the Burmese Vihara. In a semester-long study abroad program. And so over there, I met Anagarika Manindraji, who was towards the end of his life, and another teacher from Sri Lanka named Godwin Samararatne. And it changed my life radically. I remember very clearly the first night in the Dharma Hall listening to Godwin talk about the Four Noble Truths and having this feeling of coming home. Like, oh, this is why I got born. And the sense that finally somebody was talking about things that I had always sort of sensed were true, but no one was talking about. Yeah. And that was the beginning. And, you know, that was over 25 years ago, and I've been a deeply devoted Dharma student and meditator ever since. Yeah.
And you went there, you were quite young, no?
Yeah, I was 19 at the time. And fun fact, Hanuman Golman, Danny Golman's son, was on the program that year, and he and I are still good friends. Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great. He's amazing. Well, if we reach back from your first meeting there with Manindraji, I go back to when we were first there. And I met him. I was introduced to him by Joseph Goldstein. And he played a seminal part in our lives. Many of us took teachings from him.
Yeah.
And in particular, Ram Dass, I don't know if you know this story, but Ram Dass, after he and a bunch of people, including Sharon, did the... they did like several months of Vipassana retreats in a row.
Yeah.
So they asked Munindra if he would come and do a private retreat with them up in the Himalayas in a place called Kosani. And so he agreed to do it. And at that moment, we had not been in touch with the Neem Karoli Baba, because nobody knew where he was. He wasn't somebody who said, here, I'll be here or there. So Ram Dass went ahead with this whole program, not knowing that Neem Karoli Baba would appear just after. Actually, it's a famous story how they went from the Dharamsala in Bodh Gaya, and a whole busload of them. And Sharon always said, I don't know why, but I didn't get on that bus. Anyhow, they went, and through this incredible circumstance of Danny Golman saying, oh, they're near Allahabad. Oh, that's where there's these grounds that like billions of people get together, and it's called the Kumbh Mela. Why don't we go visit there? And Ram Dass is more thinking about a hot shower and some ice cream in Delhi. So he, oh, should we go here? Should we go? Because it was his, he had arranged for the bus, so he had quote unquote control. And he thought he had control. But he said, okay, let's go. And they went. And it's a famous story that Neem Karoli Baba came with a devotee in a rickshaw at the moment that the bus arrived at this particular Hanuman temple that's famous in this on these grounds. And they found that, we called him Maharaji, had said, everybody get up, 6 o'clock in the morning. There's 27 Westerners coming. We got to feed them. And he went down, found them, and brought them back to another devotee's house. So that was that famous story. But so he invited Munindra, and I had just gotten, I mean, I was in India for a few months before we couldn't find Maharaja. I was actually at Sri Aurobindo Ashram. And then we met, all of us met up in the foothills of the Himalaya in the spring of 71. And I guess Ramdas, he must have told Maharaji, well, we're going to have this incredible meditation teacher. He's going to come and teach us, and we're going to be up in Kosani. Oh, great, go do that. That's great. In the midst of it all, though, his mother got very sick, and so he canceled. He couldn't come. So the wonderful and horrible thing for Ramdas was he became the teacher, right? Which is the last thing. He didn't want to take care of us. He really didn't. He did that in America. He turned us on and all that, but he didn't want to take care of us. Anyhow, that particular moment for me, Ramdas, because I had not yet gone to the course. I was, as I said, I was elsewhere. Yeah. He taught me Vipassana. Just basic Anapana, you know.
Sure.
One-pointed meditation. And I had the opening. I had an opening kind of like you did when you first went there. I had an opening of an absorption opening, shall we say. That was extraordinary. And started me off on the path of meditation to this day. Of course, Vipassana is a major part of my practice, and many others. Many of us went and did the course. Maharaja used to say, "You going to the course?" But he would just like get rid of us. He didn't care about what, but it was good. You go to the course, anyhow. So Munindra was a big part of that for us, and of course Goenka. Can't leave him out. Yeah.
No, I feel very blessed to have met him towards the end of his life and to have had the chance to study with him. He's such an important figure in the lineage of insight meditation and really Buddhism in general here in the West.
Yeah, for sure. So this book, Your Heart Was Made for Love. And I quote you, for connection, belonging, and meaningful relationship with other people, beings, and the earth. Your heart was made to give and receive, to know joy, purpose, and freedom. All of this is possible for you and for each of us, yet painful emotions, ignorance, and oppressive conditions disconnect us from our heart's potential. And here we are in this present moment, which is so, so difficult to even grasp these words. As I said in the very beginning, boy, that heart's got to grow exponentially to be able to encompass the suffering that is going on right now. What led you to even, you know, to consider this, and how relevant is it now?
Yeah, thanks, Raghu. Well, in many respects, the book grew out of the really tragic and challenging events of 2020. It was when I started writing the book after not just the pandemic, but George Floyd. And then we had those devastating wildfires out here in California. There was that day in September where we couldn't see the sky. It was this eerie orange gray color. And as a meditation teacher, one of the ways I felt like I could contribute was to try to broaden the scope of what people think of as meditation or contemplative practice beyond things like anapanasati or concentration to a skill set for life. And to try to talk about some of the capacities we have innately as human beings that we can strengthen, that we can cultivate, and that can then be a resource for us in such painful and overwhelming times. So I do think the book is sadly even more relevant now than when I wrote it. There's a little bit of a play on words there in the title, because in some respects, I don't think our hearts were made for this, meaning this current historical moment. I don't think our hearts were designed to contend with the level of trauma and horror and the immense access to information that we have, the level of fragmentation and distraction we are subjected to on a daily basis. All of this is not what our nervous systems were designed for. So what the title really means to me is that our hearts were made to flourish. We are born with these immense capacities and this beautiful potential to contribute and grow and flower as human beings if we receive the right nourishment and if we know how to water those seeds. And of course, the more we do that, the more we use our time every day in the simplest of activities to develop strengths, to recognize and deepen our ability to be balanced, to be kind, to be patient, the more we're actually able to respond and contribute to the crises that we're facing.
Yeah, and I think resilience is also a big part of what we need to acquire more.
Absolutely.
More spaciousness.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think that the different sort of chapters and qualities that I'm talking about are all different flavors of resilience. It's kind of the menu or the prism that makes up what we call resilience, everything from courage to compassion to energy to curiosity and equanimity. You know, in terms of the statement you made about kind of expanding our heart, expanding our capacity, I think for me, this is one of the areas that I grapple with, you know, in my own life, in my own practice that I talk about in the book, because there are so many conditions in our world today that stretch us beyond our capacity, right? Whether we're talking about the war in the Middle East that's unfolding right now as we record, or looking at the ecological crisis, or so many other factors we could point to.
Yeah.
One of the themes I come back to in different chapters is a chapter on equanimity, a chapter on devotion, the chapter on compassion, is this potential that we have as human beings to move beyond ourselves, to move beyond the limited experience and sense and definition of who we are. And for me, I think that these immense challenges that we're living through as a species really call on us to tap into a deeper resource and a wider sense of who we are. Because my experience, I don't know how it is for you, like my experience is there is a limit to what my heart, Oren's heart, can hold. And these things are beyond that. But fortunately, that's not all of who I am. Right. And that when I'm able to touch into something deeper, whether it's through awareness, whether it's through love or compassion, or a sense of, you know, the interbeing of everything, there's something larger than me that is holding and that can hold all of this.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a nice quote here that you shared from Munindra. Individuals make the family. Families make a community. Communities make states, and states make the world. In a perfect world, but it is reality, and it just goes back to the kinds of things His Holiness the Dalai Lama says about compassion, in particular, that us moving forward into a more loving, compassionate, peaceful world depends on our mothers. I don't know if you've ever heard him.
I haven't, but this is very true. Our mothers and our fathers, I would say. Yeah.
Well, he particularly pointed to his mother and said, I am the way you see me, compassionate. I have that because of my mother. She instilled that.
That's beautiful.
If we can share that with mothers going forward, this will change. This will be a major change in the world. And I think so. It takes a lot of different parts. And we talk about family. This is something that we were bequeathed, shall we say, in India when we were first there. I mean, you know, all in our Well, kind of like you. You went over there, you were 19 or something?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were between 18 and 25, except for Ramdas, who was 15 years older than most of us. And we were immediately absorbed into several Indian families, people that were close. They were interpreting for us with Neem Karoli Baba or whatever that might be, teaching all of the ladies how to cook Indian food. I mean, we were just absorbed into something that in my life I had not experienced. And I'm thinking most of us did not. The way the family is such a central point. Now, it is for many people still. And you know, it's just warped. I mean, the one I was in was warped. It was so. I mean, a father who my father had PTSD from the war, and my mother lost her father when she was very young, so she had her own sort of PTSD. So it was not that livable. I mean, I do know people who had, you know, very wonderful. Yes, but.
It's rare. It's very rare.
It really is. Yeah. And I with you, whether I would say there was more consciousness in the time that you were going through all of this family stuff, yet in the midst of it, a karma took place with your brother.
Absolutely.
And affected everyone really deeply. Now, not to say, of course, this happens in India too, in all families, there's all, you know, dukkha is there, trouble is there. Suffering is there. But there's a way in which they interact with it that's way different than the way we do.
Yeah.
It's less isolated, less feeling of separation, less all of those things.
Yeah, there's two things you're pointing to that I'd love to kind of riff off a little here. One is, you know, I talk about in, I think it's part three of the book, how important our relationships are in our life. And this is something, as you know, that the Buddha really emphasized in terms of the company we keep and how that affects our life, our spiritual practice. So many of us have complicated families of origin, mixed, you know, strengths, gifts, blessings, and then also challenges and pain and liabilities. So, you know, who we surround ourselves with as adults and in our lives is so important. And I know, you know, I've been so blessed to have contact with not only wonderful teachers like Manindraji and Joseph and Sharon, but also to have Kalyanamita, spiritual friends, you know, companions on the path who, you know, who I respect, who care, we care for each other, we support each other. So that's one piece in terms of the families and that experience you're pointing to of being welcomed and included in a community and how healing that can be for so many of us. The other thing I want to come back to, it's kind of ironic that you pull out that quote from Manindraji from the introduction because, in fact, I share that quote in a certain way to challenge him and that theory, which although it is quite beautiful and has, I think, one level of truth to it, I think it's also flawed and limited for the kinds of issues that we're facing today. The underlying message is if we all do our individual healing work, that the world will change because the world is made up of individuals. And absolutely may it be so that we all have the conditions and the support to do that.
It seems a reach right now. Yes, I understand.
It does. You know, the two key things I point to around that and challenging it, and it may have been more viable or true at the time, you know, that Manindra was teaching. One is, of course, the ecological crisis is unfolding at a pace that doesn't allow us that luxury of time.
Yeah.
Right? Individual change moves too slowly, I think. The other factor is, you know, systemic conditions, whether we're talking about the economy, whether we're talking about structural racism and violence, whether we're talking about the prison industrial complex or the war and the military and how that's tied up with capitalism. These are forces that kind of have a life of their own and that need to be addressed from what I have learned on a structural and a systemic level. So what one of the things that I explore in the book and another purpose for writing it in me, one of my own purposes in writing was to really grapple with this question for those of us who have such a interest in the mind and the heart and the inner life. What is the role that that plays in the transformation of our world when there is this other pressure of both the urgency of time and also the insidious nature of structural conditions? How do we leverage what we know and what we learn and what we develop through contemplative practice on that larger level? And the whole book, in some sense, is a meditation on that and an exploration of what are the specific facets of our heart that are relevant and how do we apply them in this way so that our practice can be in service of a better world. Yeah. How's that land for you? What's it bring up for you?
Well, I can be in one moment more positive and in one moment cynical about where we're at. I mean, as we all go through what we're going through right now. But I do ascribe, I mean, Ram Dass was a huge proponent of change your insides. From there, you'll be able to radiate all of the wondrous things that a heart can share.
Yeah.
And I do ascribe to that.
Absolutely.
More in my positive moments, you know, when you're not reading the news or whatever else. And at the same time, it's interesting. I did a podcast with an old friend of mine recently. We did something around this book on the yugas, you know, the Hindu thing, you know, the time spaces. That are created over large spans of time.
Eons, right?
Eons. Well, 250,000 years. You know, that's pretty good. But it was, you know, and I always poo-pooed it, but we went through it. It had such insightful things. And one of the main things that it did, it gave a much larger perspective. These things have been going on cyclically for a long time. And it's not like you get we're in the Kali Yuga and it's terrible. And then next yuga is going to be, Drupa, I think is what's next. It's going to be great. You know, it's not like that.
When's it supposed to arrive, Raghu?
Exactly. That's what I was saying to him. But the reality is, one of the most insightful thing in this particular book was the fact that there is an interaction. Everything every individual does, every karma they create, every karma they reap, everything has an action and a reaction. And we as a worldwide community on this earth affect what it is that is to go on in terms of the negative and the positive and so on.
Yeah.
And just so it backs you up a little bit so that, you know, we aren't, it was great because it led me to go, okay, you know, this is really awful, horrendous. And what's going on is very hard for the heart to even acknowledge. And at the same time, we have gotten through this before. We will continue to get through it.
Yeah.
Now, if there's another piece to this, and you know, mainly where the most outstanding piece is the ecological piece. It is so seeming rampantly out of control in terms of what we have done and the abuse we have created, and who knows what that's all about. But that's my take on it.
Yeah, I think you talked about pessimism and optimism, and I certainly can go to both places. And one of the things I try to come back to is just the sense of realism. You know, how can I be realistic? And I love that you brought in the cosmology of ancient India and this broader perspective, and the way it does come back down to the choices that we make today, which is one of the things I talk about in the book, is the sense that the future isn't written. It's not, and it's built by the choices we make individually and collectively every day. And so, you know, the sense of the transformation that's possible in a human life through all kinds of means and mechanisms, it positions us, I think, you know, the more we understand and embody kindness, compassion, clarity, wisdom, equanimity, balance, courage, integrity, I think the more leverage we have to work for change. And I'm a firm believer in the sense of that we each have our own path, and that there's no one thing we should all be doing. You know, I think that those of us who are devoting our time and energy to raising children with the kind of compassion and empathy that the Dalai Lama was referring to are doing really important, deep work for our world.
There you go.
Even as those who are advocating for policy change in the halls of Congress, or, you know, trying to stop clear cutting and strip mining, are doing really important work for future generations.
Yeah, absolutely.
And all of us doing that work, you know, we need nourishment, we need sustenance. So, you know, to come back to this theme we've been weaving through of the darkness, the difficulty, is really important to celebrate, I think, and to experience joy. Just last night, we had a friend over for dinner, and we were watching a teach-in about the conflict in Gaza and Israel. Very heavy, very heavy messages and really important content from the speakers. And throughout the process, our 13-month-old son was running up and down the living room, you know, shouting and jumping on the couch and laughing and cuddling and tickling. And it was just this beautiful, poignant juxtaposition between the devastation and the heartbreak and the joy and vitality in the moment. And it's like our friend said, it's like, there's no one else I'd rather be watching this with right now. This is making it possible for me to take this in.
That's a great observation, great point, actually.
Yeah.
And that is such a truism. And I go back to Menendez's thing that we say maybe a little out of reach considering what our times are.
Yeah.
But the family, going back to the family, back to, as the Buddha said, out of the three refuges, Sangha, community, was number one, however he said that, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's, it's truly been my experience over all these decades.
Yeah.
In terms of that which brings heartfulness is community.
Yeah.
Is just this common experience. And we do a meditation, I should say Mirabai Bush. I don't know if you know.
I know Mirabai,
Mirabai.
Yeah.
So Mirabai does a beautiful meditation in the last day of the retreats that we ran in Maui with Ram Dass all these years, and we're doing it again at the end of this, at the end of November here.
Oh, yeah.
Just like me. People sit and just gaze at each other, and there's a set of, you know, circumstantial questions and answers that people give to each other.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And but just to show, yes, you are just like me.
Yeah.
And the more that we can do that, of course, the more that we can consider that the family idea from Munindra is a workable situation, even if it doesn't lead to states changing the kind of leaders that have put extreme pressure on us as people, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm familiar with his that meditation. It's very, very powerful one. It's one that I use in my work also when I teach communication and empathy.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much wisdom in it because, you know, if we look at programs throughout history and throughout the world of peacemaking and reconciliation. Whether it's the work that peace groups are still doing between Israelis and Palestinians, or the work that's been done in areas like, you know, Rwanda, the genocide that happened there, or in Bosnia-Herzegovina, it's all based upon developing empathy and starting to see who we perceive as our enemy as a fellow human being. You know, I watched a documentary, Raghu, recently on the Oslo Accords. Just going back through some of the history and, you know, trying to understand, you know, where have we been and how did we get here? And one of the things that really stood out to me about the peace process, I think the name of the movie is called the Oslo Diaries, and it's told from the diaries of the mediators and negotiators who originally got in touch with each other under the radar and started to develop relationship. The turning point in the initial negotiations was when the two sides were able to agree on the importance of mutual recognition. That the Palestinian Authority recognized the right of Israel to exist in security, and the Israeli side recognized the right of the Palestinian people to a state. That was just this mutual recognition, which is what is based in empathy, is based in seeing the humanity of the other. So that, just like me, meditation, I think, is important medicine for our time.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, on a much larger scale,
right?
It doesn't scale up. Let's put it that way.
It doesn't. You know, I mean, I've been talking about this with some of my friends in the nonviolence movement. I have some colleagues who do work in the prisons and do something called prison. Victim-offender dialogues is the technical name for it. I talk about it in the book and the chapter on empathy, and they bring together people who've been sometimes convicted for murder and family members of those who were murdered for healing dialogues. And it's possible, you know, it takes a lot of preparation, it takes a lot of support, but one of the things that Marshall Rosenberg, the founder of nonviolent communication, was a big proponent of, I know that Thich Nhat Hanh talked about before he died, was the need to televise these kinds of transformations and healing relationships. Because how do we scale it? As you pointed, there's not enough time or resources to do this kind of healing on an individual basis for everyone. But with media, with the technology that we have, we can broadcast it. And there's something profound that happens when we witness another human being's healing and transformation. And so I do think there's a possibility there. At the risk of kind of directing our conversation too much, I want to come back to Menindruji. And another favorite story of mine, of his, that you've undoubtedly heard, but not sure if listeners have. Some of your colleagues, I'm sure, were with him in Bodhgaya. I was not there. It was before my time. So Joseph, Sharon, others were with him in Bodhgaya. And somebody asked him, you know, Menindra, why do you meditate? Why do you do this? And his answer startled them. He said, I meditate so that when I'm walking into town, I don't miss the little purple flowers by the side of the road.
No, I don't know that.
And so, you know, just again, coming back to this, the, you know, as we talk about the heaviness of our world today, the importance of joy and beauty and gratitude and celebration and being able to not overlook the goodness that's present in our own hearts and our lives and around the world. You know, one of the things that's carrying me through this time is remembering all of the people who are brokenhearted over what's happening, all of the people who want peace, who are calling for a different way forward. Because if you look at the news, you don't hear that, but it's happening. It's important for me not to overlook that.
Yeah. I liked something in the book that takes it all down to us as individuals.
Yeah.
Dealing with our day-to-day, which is my favorite subject, and dealing with Mr. Me, 24/7. I just did an audio book that just came out, a movie of me to the movie of we.
Oh. That's
something Krishnadas, who I think you know who that is.
Yeah, yeah.
He talks about it. You wake up in the morning, you're the protagonist, the writer,
yes,
the director, the producer. In fact, you even write your own reviews 24/7. And, you know, so my friend Duncan Trussell is another podcaster, and I got together, and over years, just different chats, you know, and they reflect different times in our lives as we were going through all of this process. But here's one you mentioned. You say, fortunately, it doesn't take a major life event to begin tending the heart. The next time you're doom-scrolling or caught in a mental loop, consider how to spend your time and energy. Or as it's funny, because we made a comment in this audio book that we did, you know, wake up, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning after your gummy bear has hit and you're scrolling and buying shit off Amazon all night, that kind of a thing. So are you oppressed by the habits of your mind, pulled along by negative rumination, subjected to whatever topic happens to have been planted in your feed by the latest headline or advertisement on social, right? With practice, you can change the channel, choosing where you place your attention instead of having it chosen for you. That's a crucial, it seems like just a throwaway fun little thing, but to me it's absolutely crucial, because it's what's going on because of our self-obsessive nature that has been completely supported by every, you know, the expansive movement of digital media,
yeah,
and now AI. I mean, it's really quite something. What caught me was change the channel. That we really all have that opportunity.
And
Ram Dass did a wonderful thing many decades ago, I think, about, okay, here's the channels. And he equated the channels to the chakras. And this is the channel of security. And this is a channel of lust and so on. But you can flip those channels and you get into a channel. And then later in his life, which was interesting, that it was a play on a Buddhist term. Instead of loving kindness, it was loving awareness.
Right.
In fact, Jack has taken that over since then.
Yeah.
And, you know, many of our friends loved it. And it's from that place of no judgmental thing, starting with oneself, that that change of heart can really take hold.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more that it's essential, it's foundational, and it's why that's in the first chapter, why the first chapter is about wise attention and developing this capacity to be aware of our attention and to make more conscious choices about where it's going. And I would even go further and say it's not just that, you know, this being supported, this sort of self-centeredness and unhealthy habits are being supported by technology and social media. I'd say it's being actively exploited, right?
Yeah,
it's being
absolutely.
Co-opted and profited off of. And so, you know, where I use the analogy of farmers fighting for the rights to their seeds, it's like we're spiritual warriors in a battle for the right to our own attention in relation to technology and the media. And so it's essential that we develop the capacity to reclaim how we use our attention and where we place it if we want to have any leverage over how we live our lives.
Yeah.
Let alone shape our world in a different way.
Yeah, no, super, super important. There's I think you've mentioned that there's, you've kind of put together different chapters, renunciation, courage, and so on and so forth. There's one thing here around courage, which is extremely important. And so much so that this is a story I've told a billion times, but I don't think you know it, so I'll share it with you. And it's so important, one could hear it a billion times. Krishna Das was in with Neem Karoli Baba somewhere in Mumbai, actually. And he would come by and visit Krishna Das in his hotel. Anyhow, he was with an Indian man who was interpreting. And suddenly he blurts out to Krishna Das, courage is very important. So the translator who translated that actually said to Maharaj Neem Karoli Baba, well, wait a minute now. That's kind of like an action you do for yourself, but this is all about Guru's grace, this whole tradition, bhakti yoga, right? Maharaji didn't say a word to him, turned back to Krishnadas and emphasize again, courage is really important. Krishnadas, for the rest of his life, to this day, whenever there's any kind of negative circumstances or so on, he has that to fall back onto what it completely means relative to connecting to the deeper part of yourself and being able to have the spaciousness to work with a situation in its most simple way. And in the book, though, your book, you mentioned something that I think people miss that's really important. I'm glad you wrote it. A great myth about courage is that it means not feeling afraid. That is so true. But in fact, far from being the absence of fear, courage is the willingness to be present and vulnerable, meeting what is happening with an open heart in spite of fear. Very good, Oren. I love that.
Thanks, Raghav. Yeah, I mean, I think it takes...
I mean, especially today, my God.
Right. Yeah, no, it takes tremendous courage to be awake in our world today, you know. My wife came to me a little over 2 years ago. We're both in our 40s. We've been together almost 10 years now. And she said, I think I want to have a kid. And, you know, when we got together, we talked about it. We were both in our 30s and we were both on the fence. We were both sort of like, well, you know, I'm okay. Maybe if you really wanted to, I could probably be talked into it. But, you know, it's not top of my list to have children. So, you know.
You were a monk too, right?
I was. This is right after actually I left being a monk. So, you know, the default there was that we would not have children. And so it took me by surprise.
You agreed when you got together?
Well, it wasn't a kind of explicit agreement, but we talked it over. You know, we want to see, are we on the same page here? Because if we're not, that's, you know, it's important to know going into the relationship with open eyes. Are we aligned with our priorities? And we were. And so this was a change. This was a shift. And one of the qualities that was really necessary for me in saying yes and walking through that door with her was courage. You know, was the courage to bring new life into a world that is so profoundly challenged, as well as the courage to open myself to the excruciating vulnerability of loving another being that ultimately I cannot protect or control. And so I think it takes courage to love, because to love is to risk losing that which we care about.
That happened to me. I didn't lose my child, but I came really close. I got just over a year older, spinal meningitis.
Oh gosh.
and rushed to a hospital. We were in New Mexico, and this day I experienced that horrible, sinking, awful feeling. You had no way of dealing with it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Thank God my wife, who's the mother of our children, although we're not together that way, she had tremendous courage and singularity of purpose in terms of really opening herself up in one way to the pain, and in another way, converting that into positive energy and sending that into this child, this baby.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, it was, fortunately, we had some great family in India. I can hear somebody.
He's run around outside there.
Yeah. Fortunately, with this great family we had and a lot of prayers. Prayers do work, everybody out there, by the way, on every level.
Mm.
That vibration is as real as a thought in your head that you think is real. Maybe not real. I went to stay at a friend of mine's after, you know, a few days of this horror in the ICU of children. I mean, that's like the worst.
Yeah.
Neem Karoli Baba came to me in a dream and said, he'll be okay.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
I went in the morning, he woke up.
Wow.
And so, you know, we had that wonderful feeling of being taken care of, and we were taken care of. But I think I failed the courage test in the moment that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being so out of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to say this stuff and something else to enact it. And the only way is to practice.
Yeah.
You can't get away from it.
That's right. Yeah. And, I'm glad you bring up this theme of courage, because I do think it's what all of us are being called to in a certain way today, you know, is to have the courage to stay present, right? To not shut down completely. I just published a piece, you know, it's important to shut down sometimes. I think our hearts need rest. We need to turn away. We need to give ourselves permission to take breaks and shut off, but always with that intention of coming back. And I certainly can't see the way forward or where we're going, but I do want all of us to have the courage to stay present and to just take the next step, which sometimes is all we could do.
Yeah. What did you just said you wrote an article?
Just my blog. Just sharing some tips about, you know, how do we get through this time? What are our resources, you know, and just allowing the heart to close was one of the first things that I talked about. Giving ourselves that space.
Well, I'd love to, and our listeners, I'm sure, would love to see this too. So send me a link and then we'll get it, get the people who put this all together on Be Here Now Network to put a link in there for that blog and as well, of course, the book.
Sure thing.
You'll be able to catch all of that. You know, I thought, being that you're a meditation teacher, that you would give us a little bit, a 5-minute meditation would be fabulous, Oren. And
I would be happy to.
I hate to be so bossy and producery, which is what I am, but around ease, I love that whole concept that's very prominent. Well, it's a chapter in the book.
Yeah.
Something around that. I think it's what people could really use today.
Sure. Yeah, maybe we can wrap it up here and offer lead a meditation and time for me to go take care of my son.
Yeah.
Sure. So, you know, let yourself get comfortable. Roll your shoulders, take a deep breath, just whatever helps helps the folks listening to shift gears, you know, kind of put things down and turn your attention inwards. I like to close my eyes. You might want to just gaze down at the ground in front of you. And maybe just to first to feel the weight of your body and the contact with the ground. Just notice the places your body is touching the earth. And feel the pressure there, the steadiness of that contact. And see if you could tune into the experience of being supported by the ground. There's something solid, there's something stable beneath you that's holding us up, that we can rest on, we can lean on. And how would it be to let your whole body just receive that sense of support? Just letting every cell and every tissue rest into that stable, steady ground beneath us. So with each breath, with each moment, giving the weight of your body to the earth, letting it hold you. However you're doing in this moment, whether you feel relaxed or keyed up, just remembering that your experience is entirely natural and normal. Just like the weather, it changes. How can we invite some ease into this moment? Well, one way of doing that is to remember a time or a moment that you felt ease, or even to think of something that represents ease for you, an image. The waves of the beat of the ocean crashing on the beach. The sound of the wind blowing through the leaves and the trees. Sun setting. Anything real or imagined that evokes a felt memory of ease in your body right here and now. Using this memory or this image, making it as clear and vivid as possible. And then just letting yourself receive it, seeing if you can allow your breath to flow a little bit more easily. Just letting it come and go, softening or relaxing the jaw. Allowing yourself to be carried, to be supported. And remembering that you can come back here anytime you need. It's always available in the present moment. Like a cool breeze on a hot day. Remembering your capacity for ease. And then whenever you're ready, slowly letting your attention shift. Coming back to the space where you are, letting your eyes open. All right.
Thank you so much, Oren.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Everybody, you'll get connected with Oren through the show notes on Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And... also, take advantage of Sharon Salzberg and what she does. It's phenomenal on her podcast. So we shall see you next week. And again, thank you.
Thanks, Rago.